From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
And then the cultural renaissance in Paris, the renaissance.
You know, I mean, I've gone through many iterations of trying to find the word for this. And at the end of the day, I think the best word is he's just crazy.
Then I think the reason why in Ireland in particular, you've got a big popularity when it comes to making horror movies here is that Ireland as a country has so many associations with horror.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, the walrus with the Goldilocks complex, the calamitous last days of the Trump administration, and how Oprah and Jay-Z get their oats. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's not too hot, not too cold, but just right. The usual light-hearted musings on the news, or newsings, as I've been calling them, stubbornly but vainly hoping it'll catch on. We're a shade darker on the Ryan Tuberty Show this morning as our host considered the ongoing situation in Afghanistan.
To see people, human beings, hanging onto wheels of an airplane and to climb in under the wing. I mean, think of even the metaphor of trying to climb in under the wing of American protection. But to climb under the wing of an American Defense Forces plane, fleeing the scene of the 20-year crime and these people then falling from that plane at some point. Imagine what's going through their head. How desperate must you be? How awful must any possible future you might have be or feel like if you think that your best chance is to get onto the climb onto a bit of the plane outside the plane? It is remarkable and deeply, deeply troubling to see the scenes there. Like I said yesterday, even the scenes of the women having to cover themselves up further and hide themselves more back into the shadows with them. It's quite distressing. And there was a salon, the hair salon, I think I might have mentioned this, but the hair salon with the pictures of women with their new hairstyles and so on outside. They're all painted over now because they were just too, can't be seen to be exposing your face in public. They were going back decades, and some might say centuries now, with the Taliban there. There's a woman, she's on again this morning on Morning Ireland. She's very, very clear in her pretty angry take on this as a journalist. And she just left Kabul. She was talking to Mary Wilson this morning. Lynn O'Donnell is her name. And she's very good. And she was just talking about the Taliban being essentially drug dealing misogynists who are now running the show. And it is poor. And Joe Biden came out and defended his position last night, essentially saying, look, it was Trump's peace that he made with the Taliban, and we were just coming good on that. But he stood by his quote unquote guns, if you like. Trump had made comments about 2 months ago talking about how he wanted this to happen. He wanted the great withdrawal and he wanted that to happen. And that's what they were saying this morning as well. There's this sort of spiritual, emotional connection to getting out of there before the 9/11 anniversary, 20 years coming up in a couple of weeks' time. Get out of there. Here's what Trump said.
I started the process. All the troops are coming back home. They couldn't stop the process. 21 years is enough, don't we think? 21 years. They couldn't stop the process. They wanted to, but it was very tough to stop the process when other things were out. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It's a shame. 21 years by a government that wouldn't last. The only way they last is if we're there. What are we going to say? We'll stay for another 21 years, then we'll stay for another 50. The whole thing is ridiculous. So we're bringing our troops back home.
And they are. There's a tweet from David Beard, who said last year National Geographic featured a woman mayor in Afghanistan as part of a story on worldwide advances for women. Today, that official, she's 29 years old, said her name is Zarifa Ghaffari, said she could not escape Afghanistan and is waiting for the Taliban to kill her. That is the stark snapshot of what's happening over there. There was a speech that's been doing the rounds as well, one by the late Tony Benn, who many of us will remember as the pipe smoking. He would have been called, quote unquote, again, a real lefty in British politics around in the 70s and 80s. And I don't say that in a pejorative way. It was just that was the expression that would have been used then. And he gave this speech. That's kind of in talks, asks the question, aren't Arabs terrified.
But I was in London in the Blitz in 1940, living in the Millbank Tower where I was born. Some different ideas have come in since. And every night I went down to the shelter in Thames House. Every morning I saw Dockland burning. 500 people were killed in Westminster one night by a landmine. It was terrifying. Aren't Arabs terrified? Aren't Iraqis terrified? Don't Arab and Iraqi women weep when their children die? Doesn't bombing strengthen their determination? What fools we are to live in of a generation for which war is a computer game for our children and just an interesting little Channel 4 news item.
Again, stark but impressive. You don't hear too much oratory like that too, do you, in parliaments or the Dáil or even the parliament across the way these days. But very eloquent man, Tony Benn, no doubt about that. That's what, it's just one of those speeches doing the rounds in the last 24 hours or so.
Let's pivot into a consideration of the uniforms of the great and powerful, starting with one of the most iconic CEOs of the last 30 years. If Ryan can remember his name, that is.
Steve.
Go on.
Jobs.
Got it!
And the black turtleneck or polo neck that he wore. There's a whole history of it. That because Elizabeth Holmes, there's a great documentary about her, podcast about her and her lab testing company. But she was often said that she had 150 of these turtlenecks. It's my uniform, she says. It makes it easy because every day you put on the same thing. You don't have to think about it. It's one less thing in your life. But Steve Jobs was rarely pictured without his Izzy Miyake turtlenecks. Gosh, so he obviously paid a few quid for his ones. No 5 euro pennies harmed in the making of that turtleneck. And they suggested that he was a different kind of businessman, a visionary who didn't play by the boardroom rules. But it wasn't as sloppy as a T-shirt and not as priggish as a shirt and tie. So the turtleneck, it's been going for, started off as a polo playing uniform in the 19th century. And then it just snowballed into different, the bohemians in the 20th century. Noel Coward did a job for it in the 20s. And then the cultural renaissance in Paris, the renaissance with the jazzers, then after the war for aspirant existentialists. And then in the 70s, they became very colourful as per Leonardo DiCaprio in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And then it was kind of more power move thanks to Jonathan Pryce's character in Tomorrow Never Dies, the Bond film. And yeah, so it's an evergreen, isn't it? But not everyone can wear one. You can look a little bit odd in one, or you can look terrific in one, depending on how you wear it.
I feel like maybe Ryan was going to give us examples there of people who can't pull off a turtleneck, but no, the whole turtleneck thing just fizzled out and that was it. Curious. And that's how the newsings ended. Not with a bang, but with a turtlenecked whimper. The government is hoping that a tax incentive aimed at, jargon alert, coaxing empty nesters into downsizing will free up some much-needed housing supply. On this morning's Today programme, Philip Boucher-Hayes heard from Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson Ono Brin and Senator Mary Fitzgerald, Fianna Fáil spokesperson for Housing, Heritage and Local Government.
I think it's really important when we start talking about this this type of a proposal that we're very sensitive to the fact that we're talking about people's homes. We're talking about homes that people worked hard for, saved hard for, paid mortgages for. So, you know, I think the context of the housing crisis and the government's absolute commitment to increase housing supply and deliver affordability is at the top priority. An element like this or a proposal like this is appears to me to be one that is being progressed by the Department of Finance, and a tax incentive is potentially being spoken about. But already people will not pay capital gains tax on their principal private residence.
Okay, come to the tax arrangements in a second. But the thing, the element of this that mystifies me is, where are they supposed to go?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that would be the first question. You know, if people were going to, if there was options for people to sell up homes and right size, as it's described, I think they would be doing it already. In Dublin Central, where I live, there are some in most recent times, some very good quality senior citizen developments have been delivered. But there's certainly a very long waiting list for those developments, and that is an area of capacity that's massively constrained. And I don't think that there is an obvious, particularly in the city, I would say, solution there. So if it was an option, most people want to continue to live in their communities, live in the area. And I think that as part of Housing for All, what the government is committed to doing is increasing house supply and affordability.
Okay.
But most importantly as well, where that housing supply is being increased,
okay,
that it is designed for multi-tenure, but also multi-generational use, so that people can, at all stages of their lives, continue to live in their communities.
Owen O'Brien, let me bring you in there. Nice idea if you happen to have a couple of 100,000 units of surplus housing stock.
Well, first of all, it's wholly unacceptable that we're having a conversation about the government's housing plan before that plan has even been published. Like, this government has been in office for over a year, and in the last 2 weeks, we've had a series of leaks with little bits of information, kite flying. We're hearing that these things are currently being considered.
Well, you should really be congratulating the ingenuity of the journalist Philip Ryan in this case for getting that, rather, because you don't know whether the leak came from the government first or not.
I suspect, given that we've had five or six of these over 2 weeks, that there's a deliberate plan to leak. But obviously, that's just my assessment. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, I absolutely agree with Mary on one point. Older people living in their homes that they've worked hard for and that they have paid the mortgages on didn't cause this housing crisis. And in the conversation we have about right-sizing, there should be no pressure whatsoever on anybody to feel that they don't have a right to live in their own home. I do, however, have constituents, both private homeowners and council tenants, who would like to right-size. They're at an advanced age, they're living in a larger house, they're no longer able to cope with it. And what they say to me is they would like the option of being able to remain in their community with their support networks and access to services and live in more appropriate accommodation. And the problem is, exactly as you said, tax breaks will not facilitate that because there simply aren't the right sizing, smaller appropriate homes in the areas that are needed to meet that demand.
So would you actually be, in fact, putting the right sizers in direct competition with first-time buyers for that smaller starter home?
You see, the difficulty is if you take a lot of the parts, for example, of Dublin, where you would have people of a certain age, there are very few houses or dormer bungalows being built in those areas now. It's apartments. And apartments, for a range of reasons, in many cases, won't be suitable for older people who themselves want to right-size, either because of accessibility issues or the fact that they'd like to keep a garden, etc. So I suppose the first thing is this. If we want to give people real choice, so that if it is their choice to right-size, what that means is in future planning permissions for residential developments, whether they're public or private, it has to have downsize appropriate accommodation, disability accessible, mobility accessible, dormer bungalow type accommodation built into those overall developments. That's the first thing. The second thing is we need the government to advance its plans with respect to Fair Deal. They've been talking about it for over a year, both Minister O'Brien and the Minister for Health. So there are a lot of properties up to 5,000 currently vacant, and they would be very quickly brought back into use again, fully on the basis of the choice of the owners. But ultimately, this all comes down to the supply of good quality, affordable homes. And what we need is not for government, as was reported in another leak at the weekend, to gift half a billion euros of taxpayers' money to private developers to address so-called viability issues. We need government to directly ramp up the supply of large volumes of affordable homes, including affordable homes for people, whether they're in public or private housing, who of their own volition want to downsize. But there should be no pressure on older people to continue to live in their own home. That should be their right.
Sinn Féin's housing spokesperson Owen O'Brien, who, with Senator Mary Fitzgerald, Fianna Fáil's spokesperson for Housing, Heritage and Local Government, were discussing a possible new government initiative on so-called empty nesters with Philip Boucher-Hayes on this morning's Today programme. Christina Gallagher, who runs a house of prayer on Achill Island, has apparently told her many followers not to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Joe Duffy read some of the details from the House of Prayer website on this afternoon's Live Line.
I recently became aware that Christina Gallagher from the House of Prayer in Achill has told her followers, and by the way, she's lots of them, especially older people, in a message posted on her webpage that the vaccine is poison and not to take it, that the virus is man-made and anyone who does it will be marked with the sign of the beast. And I have here the document alluded to. Wake up, plead for mercy while you still have time. Do not be foolish to assume when this virus is over you will be free. It is a continuation of the great apostasy, the desertion of the truth. I'm reading, you will be called upon to receive the vaccine. That is death, and the mark of the beast will be forced upon you. Those who receive it willingly will die upon eternal death. I read out more as we go on. Margaret Fitzgerald. Margaret, you contacted, you're an avid follower of Christina Gallagher.
I am, yes, an avid follower of Christina Gallagher, yes. We have been visiting the House of Prayer for 23 years. We know Christina Gallagher quite well, and she's a very kind, devout, humble woman. Mm. And she's just merely imparting the messages that our Blessed Lady and Jesus has passed on to her to enable people to save their souls. She has never said, I am just going to make it quite clear that I just want to say that the attack that was made on the Sunday World of August last, stating that Christina has said that if anybody should take the vaccine, it is the mark of the beast and they will be lost to hell. Christina Gallagher has never made such a statement. We are there every Saturday. We know exactly what she says.
But it's on our website,
and it's
Christine,
all recorded,
Christina.
And it's
Gallagher.
All available on her, on her internet, christinegallagher.org. She has never said it, or anybody else in the house has said it. That's all I want to clear.
Okay, and you've made that clear. And Margaret, do you think this piece which says it comes from christinegallagher.org, you think that's been made up by somebody?
I don't want to enter into that. I don't want to say that. All I want to say is that the attack that was made on the 15th of August last, stating that she said it was the mark of the beast, and that anybody should take it, that they had lost. Christina Gallagher has never said that.
And have you taken the vaccine?
No, for I've decided and prayed about it, and we've decided for personal reasons that we would not take it.
And have you discussed that with your family, or is there other members of your family, or are we?
I don't have to discuss it with my family. I discussed it with my husband.
And did he? Can I ask? And you can tell me no. I'm being rude, Margaret. Did your husband? Did he get vaccinated?
We have decided for personal reasons not. We have discussed it and prayed about it, and decided not to take it.
And would he be a follower of Christina?
We both are avid followers of Christina Gallagher. And we know her quite well.
And what do you love about Christina?
That we found with Christina over 23 years that she's very kind, honest, humble type of person, very helpful, very loving. And she just imparts the messages that have been given to her by Christine and Paul. And therefore, anything that she says, it's all been available. All her messages are available on christinegallagher.org.
Yeah, but I'm looking. I know that, but I'm
looking.
But Margaret, Margaret, thank you, Margaret. I'm looking at christinegallagher.org and a quote from it. Your world has with, and this is a message for Mary, isn't it? Because she begins, my daughter, write down all that I tell you. It is important. And Christina is the daughter for all the people of the world. This is Mary speaking, apparently. Your world has with it the deepest darkness of hell, the Antichrist. How so many bow down to his power. Yet even more will do so in a short time. You will all be called into the suppression and dictatorship of Antichrist. You will be called upon to receive the vaccine. That is death. And the mark of the beast will be forced upon you. Those who willingly receive it will die unto eternity.
She makes the point. It's very subtle there. It said that it will be followed by the mark of the beast. It doesn't say the vaccine is the mark of the beast. That's a subtle point.
But it
there
does say,
you read that message again.
You will be, we presume when she's talking about the vaccine, Margaret, she's talking about the COVID vaccine, isn't she?
She's talking about the COVID vaccine, but you're reading the thing there. She has not said that the COVID vaccine is the mark of the beast. Neither has the Lord said that.
She's gone further. She said, you will be called upon to receive the vaccine. That is death. You can't get clearer than that.
But that is not what the attack said on Sunday last, which I'm just speaking about that particular attack. That particular attack said that Christina Gallagher has said in the House of Prayer that the vaccine is the mark of the beast and that anybody who takes it will be lost to hell. She has not said that, and neither does the message
say
that.
Well, we rang the House of Prayer, and we're asking for Christina to come and talk to us. Now, I don't know which house she's in at the minute. Is the House of Prayer in Achill? Is it the house she owns in Malahide in that gated community? Is it the house that she owns in England? Is it the house that she owns in Florida? I don't know which house she's in, but we'll phone them all. But we spoke to a gentleman who told us that Christina Gallagher was not in prayer, not available, and he would not give us his name. But he made the following statement: "We have no comment to make. What happens here is ongoing prayer in the House of Prayer. We refer people to the website to read exactly what was said. Thank you for getting in touch." The website
said. That's all I have. That's what I have to say as well.
And has Christina helped you directly, Margaret?
Sorry?
Has Christina ever helped you directly? Like in predicting things or sucker?
Christina would help me. Christina has helped us by her guidance, by her prayer, by her love and her attention at all times.
Pope Francis has got the vaccine.
I don't wish to discuss it any further. Has he
got the mark of the beast on him? Is he going to die, the Pope, Margaret? Margaret, come back to me, please. Margaret.
But Margaret was gone, and Joe and us were left to ponder the dramatic anti-vax warning from Christina Gallagher's House of Prayer. I was on this afternoon's Live Line. What was that number again? Ryan Tuberty had an unpleasant encounter on the street recently, and he spoke about it this morning, although he had some misgivings about doing so.
I was in two minds about whether I was going to say the next thing I'm going to say to you, but I think I will. Kind of a bit fed up about it now, to be honest with you. And this is an observation that I've been seeing around the place more and more. And it just kind of came to a little bit of a head yesterday as I was walking through the street in Dunleary. As it happens with my eldest, who's very smart, and she kind of kept a distance as I walked along the street. And a young guy of about 25 or 6, I'd say spends a fair bit of time in the gym, and he passed by, and just as he passed by, he says, "Tuberty, you faggot." So, okay. I had two things I could do with that. I could stop and ask him why would he do that, or I could keep going and not cause a fuss. But to be honest with you, I think I would have let myself down if I didn't challenge him. And it was a physical risk because he was a big guy. And if you know me, you know that I'm not one of those. But I was fed up with it because even though I spent lovely times in Kenmare recently and Clifton recently, not a bother at all, unfortunately on my own doorstep, it's becoming more of a problem with young men in their 20s. And I'm gonna talk about this briefly because I want to know what's wrong. What's the problem with these guys? I went back to the guy and I said, "Excuse me, can I ask you what you said there?" And he said, I said, "You're a faggot." And I said, "Can I ask you why you'd say that?" And he said, "Because I don't believe in your beliefs." And I was trying to figure out what my beliefs were that I've said so publicly that caused him such a problem. And I said, "Which beliefs?" And he said, "Your belief." Now, he was squaring up to me now, and it was getting a little menacing. And I knew I was goosed, to be honest with you, if he threw a punch, and I just have to accept it as part and parcel of the job. And he said, because your beliefs. I said, "What beliefs?" He said, "All your beliefs." And I thought, well, this isn't going to go anywhere. I'll leave you to it. I walked away. And I was a little, I was unhappy about it. And I was sad about it because this is my hometown. And everyone's so nice. Only a minute later, the guy stopped and he says, "Ryan, how are you doing? You look much younger in real life." And it was, and nearly everywhere I go, people are lovely. And they start, anyone who's met me will know. Can we have a picture? Of course, you know. All of that stuff. It's fine. But I was troubled by this guy. Why would he do that? And the reason I'm saying this is because within 5 minutes, having rounded the corner and headed down towards the sea and towards the different parts of Dunleary, this guy emerged from a particular building. And again, I think there was weightlifting involved. I'm sad to say, but this guy needed a bit more time in the gym. He was a bit more closer to my own build. Very young. Early 20s, and he came out and he started roaring in my face. He said, you're that virus. I said, you're a paedophile virus. That's what you are. You're a virus. And people started to look around, and I said, oh, well, do I walk on again? Or do I say, can we have this out? So I tried it. I said, do you mind if we, can I ask you why are you doing this? What's up with you? And there was no talking to him. He was reeling off the points of, I think they seem to be conversation points for people who agree with him, which is to find people in public life and blame them for all their ills. And it could be Tony Hoolan, could be Ronan Glynn, could be Fergal Bowers, all of whom I hear have been had menacing messages sent to them and so on. And thankfully, because we talk about this, I'm not on Twitter, so I don't see anyone if people are going to be problematic. But when people come up to you and do this, you've got to take it on a bit, or you can ignore it. I couldn't ignore it, and I didn't want to. Anyway, that second fella ended up walking up the street backwards, roaring abuse, and he was covering up his face because at that point I took my phone out, and I felt he was very, very menacing. So my point in all of this is, I suppose I love civil discourse and having a conversation. And I've often thought, I wonder what I would do if I was hassled. I noticed, again, other young men in their 20s passing by would casually, and it's happened, I'd say, twice in the last 6 months, would shout out the words I've used. I won't use them again. Would just shout it out as I'm walking along the street. And it's very disheartening. I'm tougher than you know. So don't worry, I'm not having a sort of why me or poor me thing. I really am not. I hope you don't think that's what this is about. I feel that I ask people to share their stories all the time, so I'm sharing mine. I think that's a fair cop. But I'd just be curious to know what's the matter with these guys in their 20s who are clearly disempowered or that there's a focus issue, or is there something that people like me have done to upset them so much that they feel that they can shout at me in the street in broad daylight with family beside me and think it's cool to be shouting the most awful names? And where did that come from? Where does that go? I had hoped in my naivety, my intellectual naivety, that I could stop and say, let's talk it out. So, you know, my beliefs, let's talk about it. What is that? All I've said since this pandemic began is let's get through it together. That's my belief. If I believe the vaccine is going to help us all, yeah. Look at the figures in the hospitals today. The people who are sick in hospitals, are, for the majority, are people who have not been vaccinated. They follow the science, follow the medicine. I think it makes sense. But there's a strain of thought in society that doesn't believe in any of that. And that's okay. I'm not against your contrary point of view. But have it out in a civil, dignified way, please.
Hear, hear. Ryan Tuberty sharing the pretty awful encounters he had in Dunleary recently on this morning's Tuberty Show. Ireland and Irish people have a long and storied history of scaring the bejesus out of each other and anybody else who's paying attention. And despite what you may be thinking, this is not a history lesson. Nope, we're talking horror stories. On This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, Deirdre Mullumby, Senior Content Executive at Entertainment.ie, took Philip Outre-Hayes through some of Ireland's dark and mythical stories.
You know, it's funny, for years and years, I could not watch horror. I'd be like the person, you know, sitting at the back of the sleepover, just watching through, like, you know, through my fingers or whatever. But I've kind of had to get used to watching them as a result of my job as a movie reviewer with Entertainment.ie. So I've kind of had to make myself enjoy them. But I quite like the genre now, especially when there's something more going on to these movies than just being a fright fest. You know, I think that horrors have gotten really good at kind of being multiple layered and have really become quite nuanced as a movie genre.
And when it comes to our influence on them, are we in Ireland punching above our weight and our size again?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think that the reason why horror is a genre that's returned to again and again in terms of Irish filmmaking, I mean, first of all, you kind of have the practical side of it in that, you know, you're able to make a good horror movie that's relatively inexpensive. So when it comes to funding, which is always kind of the first point of call when it comes to, you know, the difficulty with producing, you know, a movie or a TV series, and you've got so much fun, so much competition from Screen Ireland, you know, horror movies can be made relatively inexpensive. And then they're quite popular in terms of sites like GoFundMe, because you do have a big fandom behind horror movies. So you have a lot of people who are kind of willing to invest in them. But then I think the reason why in Ireland in particular, you've got a big popularity when it comes to making horror movies here is that Ireland as a country has so many associations with horror. You've got the pagan festival of Samhain, of course, our history with vampires, thanks to Bram Stoker being born here. There are all these hauntings and ghost stories from all over the country associated with places like Kilmainham Jail. We have like mythical creatures like the Banshee. There's the story of the White Lady. And that's just naming kind of a handful of, you know, the ghost stories and the haunted spots that you find really all over Ireland. Like you really just are scratching the surface with kind of how much, you know, history and culture you can kind of utilize there in terms of cinema.
I hadn't realised until watching the trailer for Boys from County Hell, which is, I think, has just come out, just been released or is about to be released very shortly. This early Irish legend, Avertach, it had completely passed me by.
Oh, yeah. Actually, Boys from County Hell, that was the very first movie that kind of introduced me to that idea as well. But some believe that Bram Stoker actually used this early Irish legend in his inspiration for Dracula, as opposed to utilizing other influences. So there's still a lot of kind of debate going on there in terms of an academic level. But yeah, I never really knew that we kind of had our own original Irish vampire. So it was really interesting. And I think the movie did a really good job of kind of exploring that and showing how, you know, the original Irish vampire also differed from, you know, our contemporary understanding of what the vampire is.
Let's just take a quick listen to a clip of the trailer.
This land belonged to Avertach. He drained people's blood and drink it like water.
Like Dracula.
Dracula.
I'd love to know if there's actually anything under there.
We'll find out soon enough.
I saw something weird.
Who's fucked stuff?
This, I'm out!
There's a vampire! Oh, my sake!
Don't be tried to bite me!
It's a horror comedy, Deirdre, which possibly makes it a little bit more palatable for wimps like me. Are there many in that genre?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I really enjoyed The Boys from County Hell, I have to say. It had some good laughs in it, but there were also some really impressive effects. So even I have to say I was feeling a bit uneasy at the bloodiness of times, but definitely the fact that you have the humour in there as well kind of helps, you know, for, you know, if you're not like super into horror or whatever. But yeah, horror comedies have become particularly popular in recent years. I think internationally, you know, you have the output of horror movie studio like Blumhouse. There is more emphasis on kind of horror comedies, and I think that you see that in terms of the Irish industry as well. So some recent examples would include a film like Extraordinary from 2 or 3 years ago, which is kind of Ghostbusters if it was set in the west of Ireland, and that's great fun. And then Grabbers, of course, I think that was quite a big success, you know, back in 2012.
Yeah, that's almost a decade ago now. Let's just have a little listen to a clip of that.
I'm guessing this creature bleeds its prey like a leech, consuming the blood like some sort of vampirotoothis.
Vampiro what?
Vampirotoothis. It's a rare deep sea squid. But no, this is not that. No, this is something totally different. Something alien. You know, in that it's undocumented, not from.
It's got to be worth a fortune.
Oh, here's the thing. When I tried to clean some dirt off it,
I stolen it a few times.
Yes, this happened.
What does that mean?
All this thing needs to survive is blood and water.
Could you put it on the eBay?
And the plot twist here is that the people of the island can protect themselves from the alien by getting drunk, as high blood alcohol content is toxic to the grabbers. Perhaps the most Irish plot point ever.
Oh, absolutely. That's kind of, but that's a big, you know, point of fun in it. But yeah, it's, if you haven't seen Grabbers yet, it's definitely one worth checking out. And yeah, like you said, very Irish, and it balances that horror with comedy very well. And I think that, you know, like we were saying just before the clip there, I think that the reason that is so popular with viewers is you get to experience the scariness, but also the comedy. So if you're not a big fan of horror, it's kind of the ideal compromise. But Grabbers is a lot of fun if you haven't seen it yet.
That's Deirdre Malumbi, Senior Content Executive at Entertainment.ie, talking Irish horror stories with Philip Boucher-Hayes on the Today programme. Wally the Walrus has been sleeping in various boats around the southwest, presumably trying to find the Goldilocks boat, the one that's just right. And Melanie Crosay from Seal Rescue Ireland had an update on Wally's situation for Catherine Thomas on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show.
He was last spotted on Friday, and since then, over the weekend, he must have kind of found a quiet spot to hang out. We didn't get any reports, but just this morning, we did get a sighting of him. He's looking well, he's in the water, and he is swimming west. Of course, we don't want to give away his exact location because he does tend to cause a stir wherever he goes. So what I can say that he's in the West Cork area. So he does seem to be heading in the same general direction. As you remember, he was first spotted back in March in Valencia Island in County Dingle. So he is making his way westward. So hopefully that means he will round that corner, go back up the West Coast and continue his journey far up north and head back to the Arctic.
Back up north. Yeah. And when I was chatting to you the last time, we put a call out for a pontoon for him because we know he'd been jumping on boats and ribs and, you know, causing quite the bit of damage. So you got good news on the pontoon front as well.
We did. And thank you so much for helping us get that message out. And thank you to everyone who has offered to help. We've gotten a few offers for pontoons. Now, the problem with pontoons is they come in sections. And in order to get enough of them together to be able to be buoyant enough to support an 800-kilo walrus, we actually need a lot of them. So it's taken a great deal of coordination with lots of people and lots of people that own pontoons getting together and trying to get them to where they need to be. But unfortunately, we can't communicate with the walrus and let him know that this is going on in the background. So twice now, by the time we've gotten it all organized, he's moved on to the next spot.
He's moved on. Okay.
Yes. So where we are now, we do have a very kind member of the public who actually has a rib for him. So this rib has been designated for him. A rib is a rigid inflatable boat. So it's kind of rigid on the bottom, but then it's got those sides that inflate. So it's designed to take on water and not sink. So although he has sunk a number of boats and capsized a few others, we do hope that a rib would be able to support his weight without sinking. And that, if you remember when he was in Ardmore about 2 weeks ago, he climbed on a rib and that was his home for a few days. So we do know that he likes ribs. So this rib is ready to go when he is spotted or when he kind of goes to an area where they might cause problems. Now, where he is now is in a very, very kind of quiet area. There's not a lot of people around to cause a disturbance at this point. So we're just going to kind of monitor his movements. We don't want to set something in place and then have him move on continuously. But if he does pop up in an area where there's lots of boats, say it's a busy harbor, he's at risk of doing damage to property, or he's at risk of having a lot of people surrounding and swarming him, then we will deploy this rib for him. And there's a lot less permissions involved with mooring a rib versus a pontoon.
Fingers crossed for Big Wally the Walrus. That's Melanie Crosay from Seal Rescue Ireland talking to Catherine Thomas on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. 800 kilos. Wow. Landslide is the final book in the trilogy of titles by journalist and author Michael Wolff, chronicling Donald Trump's time in office. Michael joined Ryan Tuberty on the line from the US to talk about this astonishing account of the final months and aftermath of Trump's turbulent time as US president. And the conversation started with the worrying thought that Landslide may not be Wolff's final book about a Trump presidency.
And when I was buying your book in my local bookstore, as you'd say, I said to them, this is it now. I'm done buying books about Donald Trump, and I think this is the end of it. And then I read your book, got to the end of it, and I thought, no, this is now book purchasing in suspension.
Well, I just hope that I am done writing books about Donald Trump. But, you know, we're all here. We're all at his beck and call, apparently.
Well, isn't that the extraordinary thing about the figure of Donald Trump? Tell us a little bit about entering into, let's call it the trilogy, just to give us a flavour of how the experience is being, starting with Fire and Fury. Did you go in with great excitement and great expectations, or was it trepidation and nervousness?
Yes, it was trepidation and nervousness, but unlike most other journalists, certainly at the time that this administration began, I was certainly open to whatever was happening. I didn't know what was going to happen, and I was invited into the White House, so I got this bird's eye view of exactly what was going on. I suppose it could have gone in another direction entirely. And then I would have written a different kind of book. But in fact, the direction that it went in was, down the rabbit hole, was as crazy as I think we can ever imagine, or as at least I hope we will ever imagine politics to be.
How would you characterize the mentality and temperament of Donald Trump as you saw him up close?
I mean, I've gone through many iterations of trying to find the word for this. And at the end of the day, I think the best word is he's just crazy. He exists in a different reality from the one virtually everyone else exists in. He is up close. Not a figure that you would recognize. You would not say this person is like so-and-so, because he is absolutely of another, I'm tempted to say species, certainly of another experience. And then you try to figure out how is it that a man could become this way? And this way is living in this bubble, seeing only what he wants to see, hearing only what he wants to hear, and saying only what he wants to say, because he has never stopped, he has never corrected. I think this has probably gone on for his whole life. So therefore, it's the Donald Trump world is a world in which there is only his monologue, this loop that he gets into, which no one interrupts, no one stops, no one ever says, hey, wait a minute.
He's a big man, an imposing man by all accounts. Is he at any point ever a fun guy, a pleasant guy, an approachable guy, an affable man?
Yes, curiously. I mean, he's quite accessible, because his need for attention is so great that he's really willing to talk to anyone. In some sense, it doesn't matter who he's talking to. There were people in the White House who described for me coming into the Oval Office, and they would find him talking to one of the junior most people, because it just doesn't matter who is in front of him. He just needs someone to listen. And in a sense, he can be charming because he's a salesman. So he'll keep flattery, a level of flattery that's almost unimaginable on you. You're the best, you're the most incredible, modern life couldn't go on without you. I mean, it's at this almost comical extreme. And then he can be funny, too, because he says the most shocking things about other people. And you go, oh, my God. And then you think, this is sort of a nervous laughter, but it's funny to hear someone, the president of the United States, issue these kind of dissing to other powerful people. And, in a way, you kind of say, oh, this is something that I've never heard before. So that's interesting. And then you go, as it goes on, you say, okay, this is crazier than it is actually funny.
Having studied him at such close quarters and spoken to so many people around him, Michael, is Donald Trump stupid or very smart?
I would say that he's information deprived. So when I first started to write about him, and this was like in the first 6 months of the administration, and there was the people around him, and he didn't come into the White House knowing a lot of people. Mm. So everybody's experience with him was largely a new experience. And then they would describe for me this interesting problem. Donald Trump doesn't read anything. And there's some actually discussion about whether he can read or what's the level of his comprehension or whether he is perhaps almost illiterate. But flatly, he did not read anything. So that's a problem in terms of getting information to him because he doesn't read. They said, but the problem is compounded by the fact that he also doesn't listen. So how do you communicate information to this man? And I think that's been a lifelong experience with him. So it's almost as if he pushes information away. It is only what he knows, what he believes, and what he has seen on television.
What do you say to people listening to us discussing Donald Trump today and say there's two quote-unquote media elite lefties talking about Donald Trump in terms that may be less than flattering? What else would you expect? And then they'll say things like, didn't he get 70 plus the rest million votes and so on? That we are talking in our own echo chamber. How do you respond to that?
You know, I'm very sympathetic to that, and I don't really have an answer. Mm. What I do know is that I have spoken to virtually everyone who has been close to Donald Trump for the last 4 years. The people who he has hired, who he has fired, who have worked for him, who continue to work for him. I know them all, and basically I've written 3 books through their eyes. So these are the people closest to him, the people theoretically most loyal to him. And so what I am doing is reflecting their experience, and their experience is, you know, I think all of them have been flabbergasted, confused, found themselves in an alternative reality. And there have been many of these people because they've gone to work for him and then they've cycled out of the White House, either been fired by him or just have run screaming into the night. So there's this interesting thing that the closer you are to Donald Trump, the more aware you are of the dysfunction, of the inexplicability of what has happened here. You know, at the same time, yes, you have to acknowledge that there is a whole population of Americans who are enthralled to this man. And I mean, they're often referred to as the political base, but I think you really have to see them as a fan base. They've seen this performance, and it speaks to them for reasons that, you know, I can only begin to guess at.
Let's get into some of the detail of your magnificent books, Landslide. And the reason I loved it so much was because I felt as to quote it, Hamilton, we were in the room where it happened most of the time. And what an unnerving experience that was as a reader. And I don't even live in your country, so I can only imagine what it's like for an American to read what's happening at the top of the political ladder there. But if we go to election night, and I suppose the pivotal moment, critical moment on that night was when his beloved Fox News, his essentially his Pravda for the last 4 years, announced Arizona for Biden.
Exactly. So that occurred at about 11:20 that evening. And right up until then, he was absolutely convinced that he had won the election. By the way, he's still absolutely convinced that he has won the election. But it was, you know, the celebration was in progress. And then suddenly Fox News, his greatest supporter, called Arizona for Joe Biden. And he went into an immediate tailspin. He couldn't understand how this could possibly have happened. And it was not a question of how he could have lost Arizona, which he did lose, but a question of how Fox News, a network that had largely aligned its business model with support of Donald Trump could now call something against him. And, you know, it's a part of his, of how he sees the world. You know, you're either with me or against me. And if you're with me, then you owe me. So this was the moment in which he could only begin to then see what had happened as something being taken from him.
And, you know, from what I understand, then you had this kind of alpha male ego psychological subplot of Rupert Murdoch wondering, will we call it or not? And kind of saying, let's just do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, it's one of those totally kind of riveting subplots. You know, Fox News is the key supporter of Donald Trump. I mean, you know, in a way has been responsible for his entire career as a politician. But Rupert Murdoch, who controls Fox News, hates Donald Trump. I mean, hates everything about him, thinks he's a vulgarian, thinks he's stupid, thinks he's crazy. Yet, you know, it's an insult, even though Murdoch is a conservative right-wing figure. Donald Trump as a conservative right-wing figure is an insult to Rupert Murdoch. So, you know, at this moment in time when he was told that his news desk, his election news desk was believed that Arizona would go for Biden as it did and that they were ready to say that publicly, Murdoch, who could have said, you know, let's wait an hour, let's wait 2 hours, you know, anything, said memorably, you know, him and let's make the call.
Michael Wolfe, author of Landslide, talking to Ryan Tuberty this morning. The full interview is well worth your time. Dara McCullough, farmer and Irish Independent columnist, and Liam Lynham, farmer and founder of Oats and the City, were introduced by Philip Boucher-Hayes on this morning's Today programme as having something in common with Oprah Winfrey and Jay-Z. That something? A newfound interest in oat milk. It's a stretch, I know, but let's go with it, shall we? Liam Lynham, who apparently converted Dara McCullough, if not Oprah and Jay-Z, to the world of alternative dairy, told Philip how his farm operates.
We're a mixed farming enterprise, tillage, cattle and sheep. And I suppose we've moved away from intensive farming and a little bit more into tillage. And I suppose in the last few years, we're looking at kind of options, farm-to-fork options in terms of low-input sustainable crops. And we looked at hemp and other products. And I suppose we finalised on oats because I suppose we've been growing it for generations ourselves and it's been grown in Ireland, I suppose, before the mighty spud, and it just suits our climate. So that's where the story began and the market research began. And then Oat in the City was born, and Oat in the City was launched in May of this year.
Yeah, what is Oat in the City now? Because the problem, the dilemma for most tillage farmers is, indeed for most farmers of any kind, that they end up being price takers unless they innovate in the way that you are and get to try and set their own price for their product. So what have you done?
Well, I suppose we have a background as well in sales and marketing. So the first thing we did was, is there a market out there and what way is it growing? And it just the growth rate has been phenomenal. I think in the UK, the oat drink market doubled from 50 million sterling to 100 million just in the last 12 months. And just European-wise and worldwide, it's growing. So that was the first kind of a sit-up moment and say, this is what we can do. The second was, I didn't have to kind of reinvent the wheel in terms of, like, we grow oats, it's natural to Ireland, and it just goes there. It's simple. So the big thing was getting out onto the market, and I suppose we're on the Super Value Food Academy, and we're on the Grow with Aldi programme, and we've been very, very receptive from retailers and from consumers, so it's been fantastic so far.
And how big an investment was it for you to go from not just growing your own oats, but to manufacturing, packaging, labelling, distributing your milk?
Well, look, we've kept it. We've tried to, at this point in time, we've outsourced as much as possible because it's a huge, huge risk, and you don't want to risk your farm I've inherited and passed down from the generations and throw it all away on a fad. So, look, as much as possible, we've outsourced as much as possible, and that's got us this far. And at this point, we need to make a big decision on expansion. So, we're looking at repurposing an old dairy and possibly kind of doing our own manufacturing in-site, in-house. And we're also speaking to some contract manufacturers and outsourcing that. and maybe focusing on sales and product development and getting the story out there, and let Owen the Oat spread his wild oaty goodness.
Dara, why were you so dismissive of these dairy milk alternatives?
I suppose, look, I'm involved in the dairy business here at home in partnership with our neighbours. We're milking cows. I grew up milking cows. And the notion that any squashed soya or oat could claim, when it's mixed up with a bit of water, could claim that it was an equivalent to the wonderful product that is cow's milk, always seemed that it's slightly offensive to the cow, you know, and the wonderful product that is milk. But I suppose
they don't have the same kind of feelings that you do, Dara.
I've also been on the same journey, I suppose, as the rest of the Irish agri sector, in that we're gradually realising that if you can't beat them, join them. As in, you know, you walk into a supermarket today, the chilled aisles and the chilled shelves are not dominated by cow's milk anymore. You've got a whole range of stuff there: soya, coconut, rice, almond. And actually, if you look down through the list of those things, you'd be thinking, actually, oats is probably the only one Irish farmers have a good chance of taking a slice of the action. And I think it's really interesting, you know, in the last year or so, we've seen big Irish agribusiness suddenly get into gear on alternatives to what have been the traditional staples of Irish agriculture. So look at, you know, Larry Goodman's ABP company has started moving big time into meat-free alternatives. And I think you're going to see some of the Irish co-ops out there, and particularly I've got Glanbia in mind, who are on the brink of launching their own oat drink, because, of course, they have all the facilities. They have the farmers and the growers. They're already one of the biggest intake merchants for Irish grain.
But surely if you end up doing business with them, you just end up becoming a price taker again, no?
Well, you do to an extent, but it's also about this whole business of trying to move up the value chain. So rather than just growing oats and lashing them into horse feed, which of course I know you'd be very fond of, Philip, it commands a higher price in the market if you can channel it towards humans. And the traditional outlets for human oats has been into things like porridge, but you can add more value to it if you are able to turn it into a sexy oat drink that Oprah and all the rest of them are waxing lyrical about.
It's sexy. Oprah and Jay-Z are super into it. What more do you want? I'm sold. Discussing the joys of oat milk with Philip Boucher-Hayes on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, where Dara McCullough, farmer and Irish Independent columnist, and Liam Lynham, farmer and founder of Oats and the City. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. But for me, thank you for listening, and good luck.